that door just won't close quietly, will it?
Okay.
The second. The second case for oral argument this morning is the City of Rapid City versus Daniel J. Finn Jr. and Melinda K. Finn. Justice Konenkamp has disqualified himself in this case, and the court has appointed the Honorable William J. Cirska, a circuit judge from the Second Circuit in Sioux Falls, to sit in his place. For the appellant in this case, City of Rapid City would be Michael Buller, is that correct? All right. And for the appellees would be Mr. Edward Carpenter, attorney from Rapid City. Mr. Buller, you may proceed, sir.
May it please the court and counsel. I'll start out by thanking genuinely for the opportunity to argue in front of you today. I genuinely do appreciate the opportunity. The issue in this case is simply whether the City of Rapid City's finding of necessity for condemnation was based upon bad faith or abuse of discretion. Now, in order to frame the issue more properly, more specifically, I'd like to begin with a recitation of the facts, briefly as I can. The City of Rapid City began this action and filed for a petition for condemnation on March 5th of 2002, based on a resolution of necessity. In the court trial, the Honorable Circuit Court Judge Anderson dismissed the city's petition and did find that the condemnation action was instituted in bad faith and as abuse of discretion, which of course is the issue before us today. Now, what are the material facts? Several of them. First is that plaintiffs in this case, Melinda Finn and Mr. Finn, well, we'll refer to as plaintiffs, own property in the Wildwood subdivision. They have two lots, one lot with a residence, and also lot 23. Now, the city seeks to obtain access across lot 23 of the Finn's property to basically join two public rights-of-ways and provide connectivity for future development, increase efficient, safe travel. Currently, there is an easement over that accessway, over lot 23. It exists. It's called Shooting Star Trail, and it is traveled by adjacent landowners, used by one particular landowner, Leo Hamm, whose name you will hear in this throughout this appeal. He is an adjacent landowner and uses that to access his property, in addition to several other individuals. In July of 2000, and pursuant to statutory authority, the city adopted a resolution of necessity for condemnation of plaintiff's property across lot 23. Now, as I mentioned, the court, circuit court, found that it was based on bad faith and abuse of discretion. What I want to concentrate on initially is the standard set forth very clearly in a case of first impression in 2001 by this court, Freeman v. Salas. That case, of course, guides us in a determination of this case. Very carefully and clearly set forth the standard for condemnation of a municipality in particular. That, I believe, is the critical error that occurred in the circuit court level. They did not apply that deferential standard to a municipality. What does that standard What does it warrant? What does it call for? Well, that, of course, is the critical issue, I believe. And as that court, as this court explicitly mentioned in that opinion, we believe that a standard of deferential to municipal police power seems consistent with the wide discretion afforded to condemning authorities. The power of eminent domain embodies an aspect of sovereign as an offspring of political necessity. What does that mean as a policy matter? It means a very important consideration that when a municipality condemns land, they are entitled to deference to that decision. What kind of deference? As the Freeman decision makes clear, substantial deference. Substantial deference because of the political consequences and political considerations for using the condemning authority.
There's really a difference in the facts, isn't there? I mean, in Salas, as I recall, the city took some property just for the purposes of cleaning out a waterway, which had overgrown with trees and stuff like this. And then did they take some additional land where the trees were going to be growing down into the waterway or something? I mean, and it was really a minimal intrusion, wasn't it, for one thing?
Well, certainly the plaintiffs in that case would argue that it wasn't minimal. They were they felt aggrieved because more land was cleared than they wanted. It was, of course, on their property, and there was a flood basin. So the similarity here, and I think the binding similarity for these two cases, is that there was a safety concern involved. But it was also a deference to municipality for doing what they thought was right from both a planning perspective and for issues concerning the safety of the community. In this case, there are considerations of safe and efficient travel that are benefited from the condemnation, allowing for future development.
You know, doesn't part of the deference come in because they consider the plan, they subject it to study, they decide the best route to go and everything? And whereas here, it just seems like this was the result of a private agreement between Ham and the mayor or somebody else, that that they would eventually take his property. I mean, it doesn't seem like it's entitled to the, you know, it doesn't seem to be a well-considered decision. It doesn't seem to have been studied or recommended. This route wasn't recommended by the city engineers. So I'm really troubled as to whether or not they ought to get any deference at all when, you know, they kind of like made the decision over the weekend, it sounds like.
And I appreciate that point, because certainly that's the circuit court found. But I believe they found that in error, Your Honor. And what is basically not discussed in the opinion and findings of fact of the lower court is the testimony of Marshall Elkins in particular, who is the planning director for the city of Rapid City. Now, her testimony indicates and addresses your point specifically. What she says in her in the transcript, and specifically at page 33 of the transcript, is that there was additional land in the area that would need access for development. And we'd like to have an interconnection of various developments so we could avoid some of the problems that we had in other areas of the community. What you've got here is you've got Wildwood Subdivision. To the south of Wildwood Subdivision, you have a section line. And to the south of that, you have Leo Ham's property. And then you have other development occurring to the west of that, another property. Development is going to happen in that area. From a planning perspective, whether it was Leo Ham's initial request to get access, whatever what it might have been to enlighten Marsha Elkins that the need for that interconnection existed, that's the bottom line, is that the need for that interconnection to serve future development and to provide access to these public rights way existed. That motivation cannot be denied. Now, the consideration is certainly, council will argue that this wasn't merely a product of an agreement to appease Leo Ham, needs to be addressed as well, because the court found, and part of their main consideration was that the main reason for condemnation was to further a private interest. Well, there's no question that condemnation, in a sense, does further Leo Ham's interest. He wants access to that, that public right-of-way through Shooting Star Trail. I should remind you, first of all, though, that under the current conditions, Mr. Ham can travel on Shooting Star Trail and access his property. The point is that this condemnation serves the public good as a whole because it provides development for the community. It provides access for the community for that future development. It provides access for the safe and efficient travel of emergency vehicles if need be. It provides safe and efficient travel for the future development. And that is the public good addressed here. It is not just merely to appease a private individual and a private agreement. There is a motivation for the public good that cannot be denied, and that is what I believe Freeman v. Salas requires deference to, is the fact that there isn't just a superficial pretextual claim for condemnation in this case, and for the public good. There is a real benefit.
The circuit court considered that, didn't he? It looks to me like the circuit court considered that, but yet also looked at the city's abandonment of a long history of declining to use this property, which it now wants to do.
And I'll speak to that abandonment if I could. The issue there is not necessarily, as framed in the lower court level. What they looked at is part of one of the Pheasant Ridge factors noted in the Freeman v. Salas case is looking at standards to determine whether or not abuse of discretion or bad faith occurred here. Is did the city, in the act of their condemnation, abandon past practices? Well, the answer to that question is definitely not. They didn't do so.
Well, there's evidence. I mean, there's record evidence that they did. And, I mean, don't we have to rely to some extent on the trial court's evaluation of that?
I think, first, I mean, certainly there are factual considerations that you can rely on from the lower court. Those factual considerations that don't involve mixed questions of law, you give a clearly erroneous standard to. You can give deference to. However, what I'm asking for here is the standard of Freeman v. Salas, which requires findings of bad faith and abuse of discretion, to be given a presumption in favor of the municipality.
Weren't you allowed to argue that law to the trial court here? Freeman
yes,
had already been decided.
Absolutely, we're allowed and did argue that, and that's why we're here. We don't believe that the circuit court followed that deference. We don't believe they gave deference to the municipality.
So you're saying the circuit court made a factual error in this case because it had before it the correct law?
I'm saying they made a factual error in some respects because of some of their factual findings weren't supported. But more importantly, what I'm saying is that the Freeman v. Salas standard is a presumption before you get to those factual inquiries. It's a presumption that going in, the municipal acted validly. They acted in the best interests of the public good, which they did. That's the presumption that you go going in. And again, Freeman v. Salas makes clear that those considerations are there because of political sovereignty issues.
Of course, that presumption is rebuttable, and until that statute was passed, I think it's about 20 years ago, there was very little judicial review at all of a governmental entity's authority to condemn. Apparently, the legislature must have had some concerns that authority was being abused when they came up with these kinds of statutes.
Absolutely, and very good concerns, because absolutely there are conditions when a municipality can abuse discretion, and they can institute bad faith. And I think Pheasant Ridge gives us an example of those particular cases. I got you at Pheasant Ridge, which is actually a Massachusetts case decided in 87. It is listed in the Freeman v. Salas decision with authority for conditions when bad faith may exist, and they can under certain circumstances. And I would argue that in Pheasant Ridge itself is a perfect example where a court does need to step in and say bad faith occurred here. To give you a basic snapshot of what the facts were in Pheasant Ridge, the municipality condemned 14 and a half acres of property. And they did so for the stated purpose of recreation and a park area. Well, the facts of the case show you that without opposition from the municipality, an entity had submitted a permit to the city for the building and construction of a low-income housing facility. Well, the citizens were in an uproar. They didn't want the low-income housing in their backyard. They went to the council, and essentially the city condemned the land under the stated purpose. But the difference in Pheasant Ridge is that they didn't have any other valid reasons for the condemnation. They couldn't support the fact that they were doing so for a park or recreation area, that this 14 and a half acres that just happened to be the same area where they wanted the low-income housing to be built. That's the difference. That's abuse of discretion. That is bad faith. It's in opposite to the case at hand, Your Honors, because in this case, we have a clear public benefit from this condemnation. We have planning, looking to the future, and recognizing the need for development, the need for providing for that development, as good planning should always do. In this case, you need interconnection of these two public rights-of-ways. Why do you need it? For the safe and efficient travel. And as Marsha Elkins clearly presented at the trial court level, to provide interconnection between two developments, to increase access. Those are the differences between Pheasant Ridge, and that is exactly the case where Freeman v. Salas should be applied to this case. This is not the kind of case that you want to make a turn as a policy matter from Freeman v. Salas. The deference that was applied in that case, the clear standard under which municipalities should act in this state, is out in the open and is very clear to follow. Now, there are circumstances, like I said, when that bad faith and abuse of discretion can be shown. Pheasant Ridge is one of them. There are several others.
Let me interrupt you and ask you. Now, on the Wildwood case, which is the companion case, the bad faith and the abuse of discretion was also a finding of the court. Isn't that correct?
I believe that in the Wildwood case, there was a declaratory judgment which repeated the findings of bad faith and abuse of discretion.
Well, in the Wildwood, they did make that as a claim as well, the plaintiffs, correct?
It was joined as part of this suit.
Okay.
And obviously the bad faith and abuse of discretion only comes into play for the condemnation proceeding.
All right. Mr. Carpenter raises in his brief that you have waived the bad faith argument and the abuse of discretion because there's a judgment entered in the Wildwood case that makes that finding. If we were to rule in your favor on this case, we would have actually have two conflicting decisions on the bad faith and the abuse of discretion.
I don't agree, Your Honor, and for two reasons. First and foremost is that if there is a finding in this case that there was no bad faith or abuse of discretion, then that is law of the case. And in that case, there would be no standing for any declaratory judgment in the extraneous case.
But there is already a declaratory judgment, a final judgment in that other case.
But again, that judgment, first of all, I should say that we did appeal that issue. It is our position that we appealed that issue in that declaratory judgment. But
how did you appeal it? I want you to fully answer, but I didn't see that you did appeal it.
Okay. It's my understanding that when we appealed this case, which was consolidated, we appealed a declaratory judgment in both actions. Right? But regardless, if there's a finding by this court that abuse of discretion and bad faith did not occur, there's no basis for a declaratory judgment in the other action as well. There's no basis in law for it.
The city can't build a road within the right-of-way you've condemned, can it?
It can. And that's the...
Well, the engineer said that they couldn't do it, that they would have to dump, they would have to dump dirt outside the right-of-way in order to build up the road.
And that's obviously an important consideration.
And you haven't condemned the additional, the additional land, have you?
Let me answer that. I will get to that point. Let me answer that first by saying that the plaintiff's expert, Larry Kosmaski, testified that the current road simply does not meet certain standards and whatever else.
Well, it's just a trail straight up the side of a mountain, isn't it?
That's correct.
All right.
I wouldn't call it a mountain, but certainly...
All right, it's a hill.
It's a hill. The important consideration there, back to your question, is that Claire Schroeder, the expert for the city of Rapid City, testified, and he builds roads and designs roads for a number of years for the city, testified that, as a matter of fact, a road compliant with the street criteria manual can be built in that area. He designed the road to be built, and he testified that it is both reasonable and safe.
Unfortunately, Judge Anderson didn't believe him, did he? And found that the plaintiff's expert, that he judged the credibility and found that the plaintiff's expert was more credible. Isn't that correct?
I believe that Judge Anderson found that. I think the issues were confused somewhat. Again, I want to go back to the deference, but to address your question.
Well, what Judge Anderson found that your expert was not credible and that the other side's experts were credible.
I think it's a complex issue. I don't want to say yes to that question because I don't believe that's true. Okay. I think there's one distinction here that needs to be made at this point. Right now, Shooting Star Trail, as is, does not require any further development for its current use to be traveled. In other words, the city of Rapid City has a street criteria design manual. Okay. Under the current use of the Shooting Star Trail Road, because of the lack of current development in the adjacent landowning area, there doesn't need to be any development or any change to that road status.
You can run down Shooting Trail Road all the way down to the section line?
That's correct. It goes right to the section line.
And you can drive it, it's passable?
Absolutely, and it is driven by a number of different individuals who own land off that section line. It's used as a matter of course by those individuals.
It's just a dirt trail, though, isn't it?
I believe it is a dirt trail. It's not paved at this point. Now, and the point is that when development is necessary of that road, based on future development of the adjacent land, a safe and efficient road can be built on that land.
On the land or within the right-of-way? Can be built?
Within the area condemned by the city. Within the area condemned by the city, certainly. And regardless, Nate, I want to focus again that even if you accept the proposition and don't overturn the lower court's finding, factual finding, that a road can't be built in the area that we specifically condemned, that does not make it an issue of bad faith or abuse of discretion, which is, of course, the issue here. It just makes it maybe an improper paperwork to condemn the right land. In essence, the fact remains that there is a public good for joining these two public rights. And that is what I want to be emphatic about, because that is what gives us the deference to condemn this land in general, is that the motivation for condemning this piece of land was to provide for that public good and increase that accessibility.
Well, if there's a condemned space where you can't build a road, and there's another space where you can build a road, and the city chooses to go to the place where you can't build a road, isn't that an abuse of discretion?
If you accept that proposition, Your Honor, but...
Well, that's what Judge Anderson did.
Judge Anderson did find that the current road is not suitable for that use, as I understand it. But what the testimony of Marshall Elkins testified to in terms of the need for the connectivity...
Yeah, your expert said that.
And in particular, that based on the design, the individual in charge of designing streets for the city of Rapid City both tested and designed a road that could be built on that section line to connect. Let me focus now, if I may, on the furthering of this private interest issue. I'm going to go back to that briefly. A case out of the New York Court of Appeals decided in 91 called Duryea versus Town of East Hampton, which is briefed, but I want to point out that it says essentially that the acquisition of private lands to establish public roads is the best example of acquisitions which confer that public benefit. Now that case is very similar to the case at hand, because you had a situation where acquisition of those of that road to provide that interconnectivity served the interests of one individual in particular. But the court basically invalidated the notion that just because it serves one particular landowner more than others, it's necessarily an abuse of discretion. Finally, before my time has elapsed, I'd like to talk about the standard for abuse of discretion and refer you again to the standards decided in Freeman v. Salas, which are very clear. And again, we're talking about the fact that Freeman v. Salas, when condemning authorities are faced with competing considerations, Freeman v. Salas makes this clear. For example, I could build a road here, I could build one here, I could build one here. They don't act with abuse of discretion or bad faith when they choose one, and the argument can be made that it could be built better somewhere else. Freeman v. Salas makes that clear, and so does the case of Basin Electric, decided by this court in 1980. The point is this, that if you can build a road that is both reasonable and safe, then the deference from Freeman v. Salas dictates that you should allow the municipality to do the planning on their own.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Your time is up. Mr. Carpenter, you have 20 minutes, sir.
May it please the court and counsel. My name is Ed Carpenter, and I live and practice law in Rapid City, South Dakota. I represent Dan and Melinda Finn. And I guess I'll get right to a part of the argument that I think is conclusive in this case. First of all, I think that it's worth mentioning that what we are dealing with here is that the Supreme Court, this court in Freeman versus Salas, said that the findings of fact would be reviewed under a standard of clearly erroneous. Also, the court pointed out that proof of bad faith or abuse of discretion would have to be established by circumstantial evidence as of necessity. And as has been pointed out by Chief Justice Gilbert, SDCL 21-35-10.1 specifically provides for this court to review these decisions. And the bottom line, simply, the findings of fact support the judgment. And there just can't be any case that could be any clearer. And I'd like to just go, I guess, to the city's own expert and the statements that have been made about what their expert testified to are not, I don't mean intentionally inaccurate, but they aren't accurate as to what was presented to Judge Anderson. On cross-examination, the city has represented that they could build a road on the strip that they condemned. That is not so. That is not what the testimony is, even by their own expert. On cross-examination, when looking at the 66-foot access easement, Mr. Schroeder, their city engineer, was asked, and what you were asked to do is to see if you could somehow make the curve skew angle across lot 23, is that right? I was asked to make a connection from the intersection of Unadel and Wildwood to the section line, that's correct. Question, and it didn't take you very long to figure out that on the existing access easement, you couldn't do it, could you? That's correct. And as was pointed out by Judge Surska, the testimony of Claire Schroeder also shows that not only did the city immediately prior to starting this trial apparently recognize that a street could not be built to meet the city standards and move the taking area, but the taking area, and this again is in Mr. Schroeder's testimony, and it's at again it's page 396 and 397, and we're discussing the area that would have to be taken in order to build a road, and we'll get to it, that just barely would meet the minimum standards.
Wouldn't they have to take the Finn's house in order to build this road?
Essentially, that's correct. And on lot 23, Finn's house is lot 22, they own lot 22 and 23. On lot 23, it would require, and this is Mr. Schroeder's testimony, it would take a 111-foot strip on lot 23 at station 5. That's mostly across their lot towards Wildwood Drive to build this road to barely meet city standards. And at Station 4.0, which is right where the access easement starts onto the Finn's lot of Lot 23, it would take a strip of 160 feet. And then to connect it, they had to move the section line over, move the center of the road away from the section line right-of-way that they claimed existed. Mr. Schroeder also testified as follows. Question at page 399. If you were in charge of the acquisition and you were going to take someone's private property to put a road on it, would you do a sufficient design to determine where the road would go and work best before you did, before you decided what property you're going to take, wouldn't you? Answer, in most cases, yes, that would be the approach you would take. Question, yeah, that's what makes sense, isn't it? Answer, yes.
What's the alternative for this road? What's the alternative access to this road?
Well, I have to go, I guess, outside of the record to answer that.
Then don't. If it's not in the record, then I guess we don't need it.
But it's not an issue that was addressed or raised in this case, other than possibly during the view by the trial court. And I'm not sure if that's evidence or not evidence.
Is the section line drivable right now?
Is it drivable?
Right, when you take Shooting Star Road or whatever, and you get on the section line, then can you drive on the section line until you run out into another crossway section line?
No, what you can do, what Shooting Star Trail does or did before the construction at Wildwood, is it goes behind the lots of the property owners that are named and then turns and goes into a private driveway. So you can drive that far. At that time, it ended as a pasture.
Right, but it also comes down and goes all the way to the section line, right?
Shooting Star Trail, as a matter of fact, it's all, as is in the findings, it's all on the south half of the section line. But I am talking about the section line, Your Honor, when I'm talking about Shooting Star Trail goes across 23, then it goes along the back of the lots.
Right, it'd be going north and west.
Right. And it just goes as far as the end of those lots. But it is passable.
When it's coming the other way, when it's coming down to the south, does it run into the section line?
When it's coming from, when you come from the other direction?
Yeah.
It does now that there has been the construction. Before it was a pasture. And now there's a big gate that ends at the top of the hill. I guess there would be like 100 feet or something in between the two properties.
When Hughes testified, I thought that she said that, and this must have been admitted, although I don't know, but she said that city engineers stated that there was an alternative route,
right,
and that this route was a dumb route to proceed or something like that.
Yes, Your Honor. What Hughes wrote in the letters and was told by city engineering is that any road should go further to the south. And I think it's an important point, because what the city has argued here today and the position that they took at trial through Marsha Elkins was that it doesn't matter that the 66-foot access easement can't possibly meet the street design criteria for safety, because it's only a driveway, is what they ended up calling as present use, a driveway. And they said someday in the future, which Mr. Hamm has testified there is no present plan to develop his property, when there is a request to develop, at that time the city was claiming for the first time you look at whether the roads will work or not. And of course, you know, that borders on ludicrous. Why wouldn't you wait? And I tried to ask, well, don't you have it backwards? Why wouldn't you wait until you knew where the road was going to go, which is a decision that would be made at the time of the development of the property, in which the city staff have said it should go to the south, before condemning an access easement that you don't know if it's going to fit the road that's going to be constructed or approved by the city or not. And I mean, as incredible as it sounds, that's what the testimony is. If you look at Marcia Elkins' testimony, that's what it is. She tries to say that even though the city street design criteria manual, which I believe is our Exhibit 12, says specifically that it applies to the construction of all roads or reconstruction of any roads, tried to basically testify it didn't make any difference that we take this now that it can't meet any standards, because those standards are going to be, where the road goes is going to be determined sometime in the indefinite future.
Mr. Carpenter, if we uphold the trial court in this case for bad faith and abuse of discretion, that's the first time this court would have done that in a condemnation proceeding, isn't that correct?
As far as that.
What standard would that actually set then for future condemnation challenges? And would we be opening a Pandora's box that every time an entity condemns, now suddenly it'll be in court with trying the whole thing to a judge?
Well, I think it's a good question, and I think the best way to answer it is this, that, you know, it's hard to conceive of a set of facts like this. The standard has been established by the legislature. You've been assigned, in effect, by the legislature the duty to look at this on the standards that are set forth. So there's really no basis, or I mean, there's really no question but that if there's a challenge, you need to look at it. But where are you going to find a case where you have a $50,000 deal between the developer down the road and the adjacent landowner, a piece of property that the city has told Mr. Hamm time and time again that you have to do a drainage study and determine and meet the city requirements before we'll look at whether this can come in, be an access road? And then add on to that the fact that the access, when they do their condemnation, they don't identify a specific piece of property, although it's always clear during the whole court proceedings up until like Thursday before when we get the exhibits that it's going to be that same 66 feet. And then you have their own engineer saying, even after we gerrymander this road around, take 111 and 140 feet instead of 66 feet that our condemnation petition shows, we can still just barely meet the minimum standards for a road that we don't yet know where it's going to go because we don't look at the roads until there's a development request. I guess that's the only answer I can give. It's an extreme standard. And I guess as we started out with the case, we started with the declaratory judgment action, and of course the condemnation came later.
What's this notice of appeal business all about?
Well, the notice of appeal, for some reason, the city's notice of appeal in the declaratory judgment action does not address at all the findings that are conclusive in this particular case and the provisions of the declaratory judgment action. And the only thing that's appealed from is the finding on the section line. And the declaratory judgment action, I'm trying to find the judgment right now, but the judgment also finds that there was bad faith and abuse of discretion. And it also goes to another point that I think is important. You know, we talked about the lack of any notice to these landowners. And as the court knows, there's a specific exhibit when Mr. Hamm was talking to the city that says in big bold print prepared by the city planning director, Leo doesn't want us to contact the Finns. And the city, when I asked them about notice, I said, you knew who it was, you knew it was going to affect their property, did you consider giving notice, did you give notice? They said, well, there's no statute requiring notice. The court nevertheless, and I think properly, found that there was a violation of due process by the fact that when what is absolutely clearly a private deal is being made with one landowner, then at a minimum you're going to have to include the landowners whose property you're making a deal to take.
And that wasn't appealed either, was it, that finding?
No, it wasn't, Your Honor.
On either case?
In either case, right, the due process argument was not appealed in either case.
So which exact portions of the declaratory judgment are not going to be affected by this appeal?
Basically, the entire declaratory judgment is not, none of those, the only issue in the declaratory judgment that was appealed by the city was the finding that the section line had been vacated, period.
And as I understand it, the declaratory judgment enjoined the condemnation.
It what? Well, it joined it for purposes of pre-trial discovery and by stipulation for addressing the issue, the joint issue of necessity only.
But
it's a separate judgment, it's a separate case, it's a separate...
And Wildwood actually, that was part of the complaint as well, was it not? About the condemnation was an issue in that declaratory judgment action.
We sought to enjoin the condemnation, which in fact was granted, and there was a judgment entered enjoining the condemnation. But while the Wildwood case was pending, the city started the condemnation case, and then it went forward from there. And I'd like to address a little bit, there's another finding that isn't appealed, and it's a case that this court has had for 50 years, and that's Rhodes versus the city of Aberdeen, saying that the city can't make a deal like this, it's void. And that was found by this trial court. And while the city has tried to say they just woke up one morning and made their own decision, there is, in Martha Elkins' testimony, and I'm not sure if I think it's page 477 to 78, there's no one, Elkins or anyone, that can point to a single staff report, a staff memo, an engineering memo, a drainage analysis, or anything else relating to the alleged independent decision by the city to condemn the public access. To say nothing of the fact that the public works director specifically testified if there is going to be a condemnation, you would do sufficient engineering so that you could determine that what you're taking would work, and of course so that somehow a court could determine what the impact on the property would be. But on the flip side, where they have no records of any studies, no technical studies, no memos of any discussions, on the flip side, we have, of course, numerous memos and the testimony of various city officials or of statements by city officials. The mayor said, we have a deal with Leo Hamm, we're going to honor it. When Bonnie Hughes called Dan Finn, said we have a deal with Mr. Hamm, it's non-negotiable. We have the memo that Marsha Elkin wrote in the conversation with Mr. Hamm, where he wanted this easement taken, and none of this bullpucky of drainage studies or paving the road or any of this other bullpucky. Well, these are the things. If you go out there, and you're all familiar with the Black Hills, there's a big drainage that runs in the back of the Finn's house. There's a big drainage that runs in the back of the Oswald's house. The Shooting Star Trail goes like that. You know, they only did a short section, but they had to cut 10 feet and then fill out into the Finn's house to build the road that they built. So it's absolutely clear this is a deal, and Rhodes versus the city of Aberdeen said, you can't do that. It's void.
How much of this road are you saying over the access now, or from Shooting Star Trail down to the section line? Is that, are you talking that's constructed already?
I'm not sure if I'm following exactly, but I'll try to. If this was the section line, then Shooting Star Trail comes across Lot 23 and then climbs up to this driveway. Then you just go up to the top of this hill, and now at this point, there's a fence, and there's a road bed that's been constructed that goes down towards Red Rock. Now, the question is that planning was talking about and the engineers were talking about is if you extend this road for access, where do you go with it? Because there's nothing says it has to go straight on forward. And of course, there's a lot of things that say that it shouldn't. And that's another point that is that the planning director testified that we consider existing development when we try to fit these things together. And that she knew and that she looked. And if you stand on Shooting Star Trail, which is all on the south half of the section line, you look 10 feet down onto the Finn's house, which is 3 feet from the section line. The drainage field from the Osborne's house goes into that alleged section line right away. Yes, this comes here, but there's nothing that says it can't turn and go to Sheridan Lake Road or that it can't go south. And in fact, the testimony or the written letters of Bonnie Hughes are in there that say that engineering said it should go someplace else. And even Marcia Elkins, if you look at her testimony, she thinks it should be somewhere else. And yet the city says they made an independent decision to take this property. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Carpenter. Mr. Brewer, you have 10 minutes, sir.
I'd like to first address the latter part of Mr. Carpenter now, who explains that there were certain city officials who testified that the road might better be built someplace else. And again, there is law from this court that suggests very strongly that in condemnation proceedings, a landowner may not object merely because some other location may have been more suitable. That comes explicitly from the Basin decision at page 388. And it makes sense from a policy perspective. It goes back to the deference that should be applied from Freeman v. Salas. Municipalities are the ones who should control the planning decisions of that city and that community. They are in the best position to look at the needs for future planning and make it the appropriate decisions. And as that sovereignty, they are given that due deference to make those decisions. And that's why court, as the Basin decision makes clear, doesn't go into the inquiry of whether a road is better put here or a road should have been put here.
Doesn't Basin, though, predate the enactment of the statute that allows you to challenge the necessity?
Basin was decided in 1980, Your Honor, yeah. And I think that the policy from Basin is still a very good one, and that is that you don't go into the inquiry of certain cities' sovereignty, and that is decisions about where to put a road, best place to put a road, should not be this court's inquiry as to, well, there's a better place to put it here, therefore bad faith.
Were there studies done in Basin prior to their selecting which one to take?
Yeah, I apologize, but I don't know the answer to that question. I'm not sure if studies were done.
These statutes were passed after Basin.
Right.
I remember when these statutes were passed, and because I was lobbying in here at the time, and people wanted the courts to take a look at these declarations of taking. And so Basin doesn't control this anymore, does it?
Well, you're absolutely right that
the legislature wants the court system to take a look at these declarations of taking from this time forward.
You're absolutely right that the statute passed after Basin, but what I'm arguing is that the policy consideration from Basin, that it's not the court's purview or really desire to go into whether or not a better road could have been built someplace else. I mean, the standard is certainly not bad faith because a better road could have been built here. That's not an inquiry for this court. And the policy consideration there is that is within the city's and municipality's discretion to make those determinations. That's the political sovereign and that policy issue from Basin. Now, because we have a reasonable road here, which is the point.
But it's certainly a factor to be considered in whether you're determining abuse of discretion or bad faith. I mean, if for example, you pick out the worst of 10 alternatives, and you pick out the worst one, it is certainly a factor to be considered by the trial court judge in determining whether or not it's bad faith or abuse of discretion, isn't it?
Absolutely. It certainly is a consideration in that sense. But the point here is that we have testimony from Claire Schroeder, and I want to direct you because I know that Mr. Carpenter read directly some testimony from Claire Schroeder, our expert, to specifically page 383 and 384, where he is showing the exhibit that designed the road that can be built over this land. And he says on those pages, if you look at the testimony, that I was asked to see if there was a possibility of providing a connection between the section line road that existed and the intersection that would conform to the street criteria manual. Question, were you able to make that determination? Answer, I believe that it does that. And the rest of the testimony goes on to explain how it follows the curvature requirements and can be built. And that's the point here. Mr. Carpenter raised the point of, well, why not wait to condemn? Why do it now? And he suggests that the timing of this gives the inference, based on circumstantial evidence, of this bad faith. The point here, too, is that there's no reason to wait. The need for this development and for this interconnection has been identified. Good planning requires that you act proactively, not reactively at the last minute. Development is going to occur. That interconnection has to take place for safety concerns, for traffic concerns, for concerns of just providing the interconnection. So waiting is not good planning. Addressing the need, identifying that need, and acting accordingly is good planning. With the issue that we, as the city, departed from this usual course of practice, I'd like to address that issue. In particular, they say that they didn't do any studies, that they just randomly condemned the property and then waited to see if a road was built. But in fact, the record will support that in this particular case, there was attempted negotiation with the Finns, for example, that failed. After that attempted negotiation, Marcia Elkins testified at trial on page 222 of the transcript, beginning there, that the usual custom of the city is to first annex property. You then have the road come under the control of the city that you need to provide that interconnection to that development, to that annex development, whether it be through negotiation or condemnation. And then subsequently, you upgrade or modify the road when development necessitates it. That's the usual course of practice, and that's Marcia's testimony explicitly on page 222. That's the course of conduct that was followed here. There was an annexed portion of land, the need for development, and the inevitability of development, and the need for providing interconnection was identified, and the city acted by gaining access to that land as a matter of necessity for the public good. Those are the considerations that require deference. And again, one justice suggested that this might open Pandora's box. And of course, that's your inquiry. At what point do we want to step over the line to abuse of discretion in the state? Well, certainly not in this case, because there are valid reasons that support the public good. And that is the underlying consideration here. Will this road serve the public good? The answer, which is undenied by plaintiffs, is yes. It provides interconnection. It benefits the public. Provides safe and efficient travel. That's undenied. Because of that, you do not have an abuse of discretion or bad faith. You are serving the public good. And Freeman v. Salas dictates that when you have those valid reasons for public good, you defer substantial deference to the municipality.
Sounds like you're advocating a return to the days of yesteryear before the statute was enacted, and taking Freeman v. Salas and giving the city pretty much carte blanche.
Absolutely not. I don't want to give that impression, because there are certainly cases where you don't want to let the municipality run wild. Pheasant Ridge is one of them, quoted in Freeman v. Salas. The case, for example, where you give this pretextual reason for a condemnation, and it's clear that you're trying to block development of there's cases of certain sewage treatment plants that the city doesn't want built by the county, or vice versa. In the case of Pheasant Ridge, there's low-income housing that they wanted to just block, so they said they were taking the land for park or recreation. No. That case comes before you strike it down as an abuse of discretion, because there are pretextual reasons without a valid reason for the public good. In this case, you don't have that. You have a case where that interconnection will serve the public good. Freeman v. Salas does give you a substantial deference to that municipality's decision. And although I do not want to relate to a situation where they have carte blanche, I do want to suggest that because of this standard of deference, substantial deference to your municipality, when there are clear and undenied reasons serving the public good for that interconnection, you uphold the municipality's decision to condemn. It is within their province as a sovereign. It is within their purview and province.
If you didn't appeal the issue of good faith and, bad faith and abuse of discretion, aren't you out of court?
I believe not, Your Honor. And we certainly did appeal the issue of bad faith and abuse of discretion for purposes of this appeal. If the suggestion is that we didn't do so in the subsequent Wildwood appeal, which we'll hear next, the issue there is not, condemnation is not implicated in that decision. If this court, for example, decides today that the municipality of City of Rapid City did not act in bad faith and with an abuse of discretion, there's no legal basis for outlawing the condemnation. We would have a valid reason to condemn. Simple as that. And that's what this court is considering.
Doesn't the court declare in that case that the taking was by bad faith and was an abuse of discretion?
The circuit court?
Yes.
If they certainly did.
Well, then, Well, then why didn't you appeal?
Well, we believe we did appeal that issue. But if we, I mean, if this court finds that we didn't appeal it in the subsequent... appeal that we're going next, the issue, I believe, is moot because condemnation is the subject of this appeal. And if there is no legal basis to suggest bad faith and abuse of discretion, then condemnation can proceed. Simple as that. And as a policy matter, we believe that because of the public good and the deference given to the municipality, that condemnation is valid in this instance, provided that interconnectivity.
Was there any reason why those findings were made in that other lawsuit, in the Wildwood Association lawsuit?
Yeah, the two actions were joined, essentially. So they're part and parcel. And
yeah, but I mean, why were they dealing with abuse of discretion or bad faith in the Wildwood case? Because the issues there are
whether or not the section line was vacated,
and then whether or not the easement was personal or gross or public.
Right.
So why was there a finding there of either abuse of discretion or public or bad faith?
Well, that's a good question, and I don't know the answer to that. I know that
in Wildwood development, that was part of their cause of action because they had a property interest in that against the covenants. Wasn't that what the dealt with? And that's why the condemnation was an issue, because they actually had a property interest in the, because of the covenants of that development, in the condemnation proceeding. Isn't that why it was part of it?
I believe it was, Your Honor. That makes sense. However, again, the reason we're here for appeal today is to determine, as a matter of policy, whether or not the city violated the condemnation and the power of eminent domain through an exercise of bad faith or abuse of discretion. If this court decides that it did not...
Your time has long expired. That's probably, you're wandering away from the question now and getting a couple of licks and you're not entitled to.
Okay.
It'll be in recess for 10 minutes.